So assignment two I posted. There's two questions. One question you'll know how to do by the end of class. So you're going to do this thing called Elgamel. You'll play around with actually implementing it. You can use anything you want. In this case, there's a website that you can go to, and if you run these functions, it will compute modular arithmetic for you. It's very simple. Like, you're typing in like two commands to answer a question or something like that. It's not very complicated. It's more about just letting you see it with real numbers, so you get a feel for how it works. So the website looks like this. And let's say you want to do, so we were working modular 23. So let's say you want to do, I don't know, 5 raised to the power of 6 mod 3. So you go 5, 6, mod 23, and then you'd hit enter, and it will tell you the answer is 8 or whatever the example is. Okay. So anyways, what you'll do is you'll do a little encryption scheme. You'll encrypt your student number just to make the question different for each person. And yeah, there's a few questions around it. The other question you can do today, so it was something that I wanted to cover at the end of class. I decided to just make an assignment question instead. So we talked a little bit about the importance of macking the padding when you do block ciphers combined with a mac function to get CCA secure. So this is a sort of known attack. I've sort of set it up a little simpler, so I've made a few simplifying assumptions. This is an attack with a name. I debated putting the name or not, because if I put the name, I know you're going to Google it and you're going to try and learn how the attack works before doing the question, which is fine, totally fine. You can do that. But I think it's actually easier if you actually think about the question itself. And I ask the questions in a very specific order to sort of tease along your understanding. So I think it's a better approach to just try and understand the question and forget about the fact that this is a thing with a name. But anyways, if you Google around, you'll find how to do it, but it might not actually help you answer the question because you're going to have to really understand it. So anyways, this is one of those questions where it takes a long time to understand what's being asked. So take your time, go through the question, don't try and answer it right away, sort of draw it out as best as you can, figure out what exactly is going on, and then once you have a good understanding of the question, it should be actually fairly straightforward to answer. It shouldn't be that complicated to actually answer the question. Okay. You mean for computing this stuff? Yeah. So it's called Wolfram Alpha.
Okay. You mentioned
Yeah. And then these are just the commands that you can run. So if you want to compute various things, you can run these commands. Yeah. And for the assignment, the numbers are really small, so you can actually solve discrete logs, and you can do whatever you want because they're so small. They're just test values. Okay. They're not actual real size values. Okay. So look it over. If you have questions, you can ask during office hours or next class. Is there any questions from last class? Okay. Yeah?
Just a question in general. Do we have classes on Tuesday, December 5th?
Yeah, good question. Okay. So because Monday was a holiday, the Thanksgiving Monday, normally classes end the week of December 4th, but for every class where you had a Monday, so that's only going to be this class, at least at night, they have a makeup lecture, which is on Tuesday, December 5th. Now, it turns out that I'm going to be traveling that day. I have to leave to go to England for a PhD defense, so I'm going to cancel that class. So what will happen is we'll wrap up the course on December 4th, and because we're not going to cover all the material, what I'm going to do in lieu of teaching an extra lecture is I'm going to make a little video of a lecture. It won't be a full lecture. I don't know how long it will take, maybe an hour or something like that. It will be just like the lectures in class, like I'll draw it out or whatever. And so you can watch that instead of having class, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do, by the end of next class, I hope to get through the station to station. And then the RSA stuff will skip. I'll put that in a video. You can watch the video. I'll post it. And then in the last class, we'll talk about the stuff that we would normally talk in the very last class, which is SSL TLS. And of course, we'll talk about the final exam as well. Okay, so that's the schedule. So you can plan on not having to attend December 5th.
So, but RSA and Christian will be covering final exam.
So what's on the video will be covered in the final exam. Okay, so I'll give it to you before so that you have time to ask questions because it won't be live. You won't have a chance to interject questions immediately through. I'm not going to put a huge emphasis on the RSA stuff because we're not covering it in class. It's fair to ask it on the exam, but it's not going to be, I'm not going to like ask you a million really hard questions about it because I'm conscious of the fact that I didn't take it up in class. So I'll weigh that in my decision. Yeah.
Syllabus. Yep. Do you have any lectures we have to cover before
midterm? So on the final exam will be comprehensive, meaning it will cover the whole course. So this is for a variety of reasons. It's actually kind of university policy. That said, most of the questions will be on post midterm material. So if you want numbers, you can think like, I don't know, 80% is like stuff after the midterm and maybe 20% is stuff before the midterm. It also gets kind of complicated because, you know, we'll see hash functions again, right? We'll talk about signatures. There's a hash function in there. So if I ask you a question about signatures and there's a hash function, is that pre-midterm because we talked about hash functions before the midterm? You know what I mean? So you can't always tease these things out because they sort of build on each other. But yeah, your final exam will be mostly material sent from the midterm onward. And you'll have a cheat sheet as well, and so you just like it in the final. Yeah.
Size of GPU.
Yeah.
Size of GPU. So we have 1, 2, P minus 1/2, and Q, P minus 1/2.
Yeah.
Is there another element except
those? Okay, that's a good question. So let's use this as a kind of lead into. So we talked about this discrete log problem. What we did is we chose P prime P, so it's safe prime, meaning that there's some smaller prime Q such that 2Q plus 1 equals P. Okay, so let's say we're working mod P. So what can we say about mod P? Well, what we can say is that every element generates something. Okay, so every element of Z star P, which is just the integers from 1 to P minus 1. Generates a set of integers. What does generate mean? Well, it means you take it raised to the 1, to the 2, to the 3 until you hit a 1, and then it's going to repeat. Okay. And so what we want to know is, first off, how many integers does it generate before it repeats, and what are those integers themselves? What are inside those integers? Okay. So every element we'll say every set, every generated set will be of one of four sizes. Okay, so in general, there'll be a size for every every divisor of P minus one. Okay. But we've chosen P minus 1, or P specifically, we've chosen in a special way. Okay, so we've chosen it so that there's actually only four divisors of P minus 1. Okay, so if we take P minus 1 and divide it by 1, right, we get P minus 1. We'll have 1, we'll have P minus 1. Okay, if we divide it by 2, then we'll get a prime number, Q. Okay. And we're not going to be able to divide it by anything else beyond 2 because first off, it's an even number, so we can only divide it by even numbers. And since Q is prime, it itself can't be broken down any further. So no other even number like 4, 8, or 16 is going to be able to do it. Okay. So we're going to have four different sets that we see. Size 1, size 2, size P minus 1, size Q. Note that Q is also P minus 1/2. Okay. And then the final question is, okay, what's inside these sets? So let's look at the set that generates Q integers. What are those Q integers? What can we say about them? Well, first off, we have no idea what they are. Like, are they 5? Is it 7? Is it 10? We don't know. Every group will have a different set of integers. It'll be kind of random looking. Okay? But what we can say is that every generator of Q integers is in the set GQ, and every member of GQ generates a set of Q integers. Okay, so all the numbers that have order Q, we'll call that GQ. And if we look at the numbers that are in GQ, they're exactly the same as the numbers that generate GQ. So everything's closed, right? It's basically the same set of numbers. Yeah, follow up.
In the case of the P is not safe prime,
yeah.
You have another site.
That's right. So if P is not a safe prime, what does that mean, non-safe? Well, that means when you divide it by 2, instead of it being a prime number, it's a composite, which is a fancy way of saying a non-prime number. And every composite number can be broken into some other prime number. Yeah. So what you'll do is instead of having Q here, you'll have some number, whatever, called Z. It'll be composite. Then you'll figure out, okay, Z is these prime numbers multiplied together, and then you're going to have orders for all of those prime numbers. Yeah. So think of it as you take P minus 1, you figure out all the prime numbers that when you multiply them together will give you P minus 1, and then you're going to have orders for all of those. Does that make sense? But in this class, we'll only look at the safe prime case. In real world crypto, you don't necessarily limit yourself. But yeah. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so what we were looking at is ways of computing different things using the lookup table. And for some algorithms, we knew how to find the value, but the best thing we could do is sort of slide along an entire row. Like, say we're looking for the number 1, so we start at the start and we scan all the way until we see the number 1, then we have our solution. And so what I was saying is that it works for these small examples, but when you have a huge prime, like a 2048-bit prime, a computer won't be able to slide across the whole row. It will take too much time. So what you need to do is you need to be able to compute directly either a multiplication or a modular exponentiation that will take you directly to the answer. Yeah. So basically, any algorithm that where the best thing you can do is scan along a row, you won't be able to run in real life with real size prime numbers. The attacker won't be able to do it. The user won't be able to do it. No human being will be able to do it. Or no computer will be able to do it. Yeah, so it's kind of like a hash. Like, nobody can compute the preimage. It's a hard problem. So it's exactly like that. So it's like literally no one can do it. So it's very important to note that the adversary and the user have the exact same computational abilities. So we talked about both of them can multiply numbers, both of them can exponentiate, and both of them can take roots. Neither of them can compute a discrete log. Okay, yeah. I don't have page numbers, but you can stop me. Yeah, these, yeah.
So in the multiplication table, it's on the far right.
Yep.
You wrote over the inverse.
Right.
And then in the exponential, when you get to the rule for 2 minus 1, the rows are 11 to all 1. So I just need to see the.
Okay, so what happens is if you want to find the inverse, what you're really doing is you're raising it to the power of minus 1. Right, so an inverse is a to the minus 1 mod p. And then we noted that a to the minus 1, this minus 1 you can reduce mod q, right? So what's minus 1 mod q? It's q minus 1. So a to the q minus 1 mod p. Okay. So in other words, if you want to find the inverse of a, you just exponentiate it by q minus 1, and then you'll get the inverse. So that's why the inverses are nicely in this table here. The 1 is just showing that it repeats. Yeah, so when you get to that, you'll generate your Q numbers, and then it's going to repeat. So the next columns will be, here will be 1111, here will be 124816, here will be 1394. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay, so the problem is the discrete log problem, or DLP. And note that if you have small numbers, for example, the numbers we did in class, you can compute the discrete log by looking in the table. You have to scan across a row of columns, okay? So if you scan across a row of columns, that's like a linear time lookup, okay? So the bigger the row is, the longer it's going to take to scan it, okay? So if we want to stop the adversary from scanning it, we're going to want to see like a 112 bits. A number that's 112 bits, so there's 2 to 112 values, and then we know we can't scan along that row, okay? Now, it turns out that for the discrete logarithm problem, there is a kind of birthday paradox speedup. I won't go through the algorithm. It's called polar row. There's a whole bunch of actual algorithms for computing discrete logs that are faster than just a linear speedup. And so birthday paradox means it's square root complexity. And so what we want to do is we want to double the bit size. So instead of 112, we're talking 256, okay? Now, the p-value actually has to be a lot bigger than 256 for complicated reasons that have to do with how fast these algorithms are. So what we generally recommend is that p is 2048, and q has to be at least 256. But since we're talking about safe primes, we actually know exactly how big p or q is. It's going to be half of p. So if p is 2048 bits, it's going to be 2047 bits, okay? But it is possible to use a smaller q. We're not looking at it in this class, but there is a lower bound on how small you can make it, so it has to be at least 256 bits. So according to NIST, p should be greater than 2048, and then that gives DLP takes... you know, about 2 to the 112. Okay, Q is half the size, so it would be 1 less, so it would be 2047 bits. You can use smaller ones. But we're not going to cover this case. And in this case, just for your information, Q should be greater than 256. And that's because there's a birthday paradox algorithm. Exactly. Yeah. Regardless of what you're doing, it should always be greater than.
Or safe primes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And the safe prime just makes it easier to conceive of Q. So I'm doing safe primes because for educational reasons, it's easier to understand. Yeah. But anyways, so Q has to be greater than 256. Why would you use a smaller Q? It's faster. So your exponents will be much smaller. A modular exponentiation will not take as much time because you won't have to multiply a number by itself so many times. So it's just a lot faster. That's why we use it. Now, in the interest of speed, what we could do is remember that the integers mod p, they're an example of what we call the group. Okay, a group is anything where there's some operation, you know, it's closed, it's associative, you know, it has all those rules. There's a discrete log style problem where you can go one way, but you can't go backwards. If you can find some other group of things that has those exact same properties, then you can use that thing instead, okay? Now, you want to really make sure that it has those properties. So people have studied discrete logarithm style algorithms before even cryptography, before this type of cryptography came along in the 70s. So we had like a very firm mathematical basis for the hardness of these problems. But lately, people have been interested in, okay, is there other types of things that we could do that have the same properties, and can we make sure that they're secure? And the interest there is in terms of efficiency. So maybe there's some group where the things that we're encoding are a lot smaller, okay, but it's just as hard. Or maybe it's quicker to do a modular exponentiation or whatever the case may be, okay? So there is one candidate group that has been looked at for a couple decades, and now like everyone implements it in this particular way. So it's called elliptic curve cryptography. Over what's called the finite field. In this case, your group elements aren't integers, they're not numbers, they're points, so points on the curve, so they have an x-coordinate and a y-coordinate, so you can think of it as a pair of values if you want. And instead of multiplication, you're doing something called point doubling. And there is a DLP style hard problem. Okay, so as opposed to working in GQ, it's faster, it's smaller. You're going to see it when we start looking at TLS. You'll see the EC variant of all the algorithms that we study. When you see that term EC, it just means it's over elliptic curves instead of over integers. Okay, we're not going to cover it in this class. They're a little complicated, but basically anything you do in GQ. You can do over elliptic curves. So we'll look at something called DHE, Diffie-Hellman exchange. So there's going to be an EC version of that. We'll look at a signature algorithm called DSA, digital signature algorithm. There's going to be an EC version of it, EC DSA. Okay. So in this class, we'll just talk about these variants. And the theory doesn't change, it's just the underlying group. That's all that changed. If you're actually implementing this, it's usually one line of code. You just say, oh, I'd like to use the elliptic curve version instead of the integer version. And then all the math stays the same. It's just that the base thing that you're working on and exactly what a multiplication means, those definitions change. But you can just sort of change a flag in terms of what you want to use. There's also a few things you can do over elliptic curves that you can't. So everything you do over integers, you can do over elliptic curves. Over elliptic curves, there's a few extra things that you can do that you can't, or it's not known that you can do them over the integers. The most sort of well-known example is something called a pairing, a bilinear pairing. So that was a course project, I think, or if you do your course project on identity-based crypto or something like that, you'll run into these bilinear pairings. But anyways, that's all like super advanced stuff. Way beyond the scope of this course. Okay, so questions about that. This is just sort of background information so that when you go out there and you start seeing these terms, you know sort of what the context is.
So you use an elliptic curve to calculate P and Q?
Yeah, exactly. So instead of P, instead of p being a prime, it's going to be some polynomial. And instead of g, where it's like g to the x, g is going to be some point x. And then instead of it being exponentiation, it's going to be like some sort of scalar multiplication or something like that. So you'll point double g x times with itself. It's just, yeah, just a different interpretation of what all these symbols mean.
But then you would still use like the exact same algorithm, like RSA.
Exactly. So RSA will be in a different setting, but yeah. So if I say do g to the x and then g to the b and then multiply them together, you'll do exactly the same thing. It's just what those things represent changes, but otherwise the algorithm's exactly the same. Okay, so we haven't seen any actual algorithms yet, so let's look at that. So we did a lot of sort of legwork on setting up the math, so let's look and see what these things actually do. So the first algorithm to be solved with this particular approach is what we call key exchange. Yeah. So Q you can think of as a number given by NIST, but they're aware of an algorithm that uses a birthday paradox. So that's why it's not 112 or 128 bits. That's why it's double that 256. Yeah. So I should, if I want to be specific, I generalize, I round 112 up to 128. Because nobody actually uses 112. This says 112, but everyone uses 128. But yeah, so what Q should actually be is double 112, which is 224. Yeah, so that's a more specific one. Okay. Any other questions? All right, so in key exchange, we have Alice. We have Bob. And they have a communication channel between them, but the adversary is listening in on the channel. Okay. And so what we want to do is we want to now try and solve that problem that we had all along, which is Alice and Bob want to do AES. In order to do AES, or they want to do AES GCM, CCA secure, or they want to do AES in a Mac. In order to do that, they need to have a key that they agree on. Okay, they both have to have the same key value. How do they get that? You know, especially if they've never met in person. Like, say, instead of it being Alice and Bob, it's Alice and Gmail's web server, right? How does Alice and Gmail's web server figure out some key that both of them know, nobody else in the world knows it, and they're going to use this to do encryption to encrypt your email as it goes back and forth between you and the server? Okay, so this was a very difficult problem, sort of conjectured to be impossible. If Eve is sitting on the wire, she can presumably do everything. And then there was a big breakthrough that applied this problem of discrete logarithms in order to do this. Okay. Now, before I move into it, I just want to say that there's two versions of Eve. So there's what we call a passive version. In a passive version, she can only listen. And then there's an active version where she can listen and modify messages. So Diffie-Hellman, the protocol we're about to talk about, it only works in this passive case, and I'll go through the exact details of why, and then we'll fix it. So when we fix it, we call it station to station. And that would be the fixed version. It will take a while to fix it because we need signatures before we fix it, and it will take a while to get to signatures because they're complicated. Okay, so the protocol is called Diffie-Hellman after the two people that invented it. Sometimes called key exchange or key agreement. You'll see it abbreviated either DH or in TLS they call it DHE for Diffie-Hellman exchange. Okay, we're going to make two assumptions. The first thing we're going to assume is that Eve is passive. And the second assumption we'll fix later too is that Alice and Bob know they're communicating with each other, okay? They know that the person on the other end of the line or whatever is actually Bob, okay? So they have some sort of authentication. Okay, so later we're going to fix this with station to station, which will use signatures. And this problem we're going to fix later with something called PKI. We'll get to both of those. Okay, and so what's the high level idea here? So the goal is, Alice and Bob are going to send some messages back and forth. And what they need to do at the end is they need to have some number that both of them know, they can both agree on. And they know it, but the adversary doesn't know it, even though the adversary just listened to the whole conversation. Okay? So imagine Alice and Bob are sitting in a room and they're talking and Eve's sitting there listening and writing down every single thing they say. Is it possible for them to somehow end up with some secret number that Eve doesn't know, even though she just listened to the entire conversation? Okay, so how are we going to solve this? Well, it's going to have something to do with discrete logs. Okay, we know that. So what we'll do is we're going to have this protocol. So here's Alice. Okay, and before we start doing discrete logs of stuff or like doing generators and all that stuff, we need to agree on a prime number to use and a queue to use and a generator to use and all of that stuff, okay? So it's not always explicitly listed in the protocol, but there's always this sort of agreement phase where, okay, we're going to do this style of cryptography using this style of math, and this can all be publicly negotiated. There's no secrets involved. The numbers, the exact numbers that you use, you can just look up. This will give you example numbers. If you want a 2048-bit safe prime, you just open up a NIST white paper and they're like, okay, here's a 2048-bit safe prime. And so then you can just use that one. And there's no reason to not use that one as opposed to generate one yourself, okay? So there's going to be some setup phase. So they'll be like, okay, we're going to use DH, Diffie-Hellman, and these are the parameters we're going to use. So we need a P value, we need a Q value, and we're going to use a generator. So G will be just a generator of GQ. Okay. And these things are called public parameters. Okay, and when you download your software, it's going to do this automatically. It will come pre-programmed with some public parameters for you to use, okay? And if Bob doesn't know which ones you're using, you can just tell him over the wire. That's fine. There's no secrets. Okay. Okay, so then we get to the Diffie-Hellman protocol itself. So I'll just show it to you, and then we'll puzzle over why it actually works, because it's probably not something you would intuit on your own. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this discrete log problem. So what Alice is going to do is Alice is going to choose a secret. We'll call it A for Alice. She's going to choose it from ZQ, so it's going to be an exponent. And what she's going to send across the Bob is G raised to the power of her secret mod P. Okay. Now, right away, let's just pause and think about what does the adversary learn? So the adversary sees G to the A, okay? The adversary has no idea what A is. Why does the adversary not know what A is?
It's just a number.
Okay, so it's a discrete log problem. So the discrete log problem says if you have G to the A, you can't figure out what A is, okay? We can call this something just so it's a little clearer. We can call this YA. So Y to the A equals G to the A. The A here is just a subscript. Okay, so this is discrete log. Now, what does Bob know? Bob actually knows the exact same thing as the adversary, right? He knows Y to the A, but just the adversary can't compute what A is and Bob can't either, okay? So at this point, the adversary and Bob actually know the same thing. But anyways, we do have this caveat. The adversary at this point does not know what A is. Okay, now Bob's going to do the exact same thing that Alice did. He's going to choose his own secret. And it doesn't matter, order is not important, so they can do it in any order. And he's going to send y to the b equals g to the power of b mod p. Okay, so what can we say about these two values? Well, it's exactly the same thing. So what does the adversary know? So the adversary knows YB. But doesn't know B. Okay. And Alice is the same. She knows YB. Okay, so just to summarize, so what is everything that Alice knows? So Alice knows her value A, and she knows, therefore she knows YA, and she knows YB. Okay, Bob knows B, and he knows YA and YB. And the adversary knows YA and YB, but doesn't know either A or B. Okay? So already we have a little difference between Alice and Bob, okay? They both know more than the adversary, okay? The problem is what they know isn't the same, right? A and B aren't the same, okay? So they both have secrets that the adversary doesn't know, but they're not a shared secret. It's not the same secret, okay? So the question is, can we turn what each of them know, their secret, their individual secrets, can we turn that somehow into a value that they both know that the adversary doesn't know? Okay, so the answer will be yes. That's what's going to make it work. Can anyone see exactly what they would do?
Raise to the power of A.
Raise what to what? Okay, so who do you want to do that? Okay, so Alice doesn't know B.
Maybe they can know what this noise is.
Yeah, exactly. So they can do that. Okay. So how do we get that? So how does Alice compute that value? That's right. That's the right answer. Okay. Exactly. Okay. So what we can do here is, let's say that Alice computed, just consider this value, yb raised to the power of a. Okay. What's yb? Yb is the number she got from Bob, and a is the secret that she chose. Okay. So what does this value equal? Well, yb equals g to the b. Okay. So this will be g to the b raised to the power of a, which we'll rewrite as g to the ab. Okay. So that's a value. She can compute it. What about the adversary? Does the adversary know what g to the ab is? So what the adversary knows is the adversary knows g to the a, and the adversary knows g to the b. What can they do? Well, like, they could multiply these two together. That would give them g to the a plus b, but that's not what they want. They want g to the a times b. So, I mean, they could try and do what Alice did. So they could take g to the a. If they could figure out what b is, they could raise g to the a to the power of b. Okay? Or, they could take g to the b and raise it to the power of a. But do they know what a is? She doesn't know what a is because of the discrete log. Okay? And similarly. Now, what about Bob? What can Bob do? Okay, so what Bob can do is... Exactly. Okay, what Bob can do is he can take YA, which is the value that he received from Alice, and he can raise it to his power B, his private secret exponent. Then he'll get y to the a raised to the power of b, and this will get g to the ab. Okay? So g to the ab can be computed by both Alice and Bob. It's computed differently. Okay? They're not computing it the same way. Okay? But they are arriving at that shared secret. And even though the adversary knows g to the a and g to the b, there's no way or no known way to compute g to the AB from it. Exactly. So the algorithm is known. So the adversary knows that not only is this some random value going across, but no. Bob's going to take it, and he's going to raise it to his power b, and vice versa. Yeah. So what's the secrets in this whole algorithm? The adversary knows all the setup. They know they're using dh. That's what I meant by use dh, so they know the algorithm. The only secret is a and b, so the adversary doesn't know the exact value of a and the exact value of b. Okay. Why does this work at kind of a conceptual level? It's because... you can think of, if you take a value and you raise it to the power, g raised to the power of that value, it's kind of like a hash function, right? It's a one-way function, okay? So g to the a, you can't get a back, okay? But it's sort of like a hash function in this regard too. It's a malleable hash function, meaning if I have the value g to the b, even though I have no clue what the value b is, I'm able to multiply it by some value a. Right, so I can take your g to the b. I have no idea what your g to the b is, and I can turn it into g to the b times a, where I get to choose a. Okay, so that's a malleability issue. Okay, similarly here, if I see your g to the a, I don't know what a is, but if I want to create g to the a b using your a that I don't even know what it is, I know how to do that. Okay, so there is this very specific malleability property, or here it's when we're in the math side, it's called a homomorphism. So it's homomorphic is the term that we use. Okay, so because we have this sort of hash function that's also homomorphic, it allows us to do this. And it turns out that if you have other hash functions that have the same sort of malleabilities, you could use them instead as well.
Sir, in the meantime, is it possible that Eve is sending a different message to like Alice?
Yeah. So what we assumed is that Eve is a passive adversary. So she's not going to change these numbers. Yeah. And if she can change them, it actually breaks down. Yeah. The whole protocol will break down. Okay. So we'll show that in a few minutes. Now, I want to come back to this because it's a little nitpicky of a point. I said there's no known way to compute g to the a b given a g to the a and g to the b. Now, one way you could do is if you could break discrete logs. Okay, so if you break discrete logs, you would take a out and then raise g to the b to the power a or vice versa. Okay, so computing g to the a b from g to the a and g to the b is no harder than solving a discrete logarithm. Okay, but it could be easier. There might be a more direct way of doing it where you don't have to solve a discrete logarithm, okay? We don't know of a particular way, but it's possible that it does exist, okay? So we're very, very careful to say that this isn't exactly solving discrete logarithms. It's something that's close, probably it's conjectured to be as close to as hard as solving discrete logarithms, but it's not exactly the same, okay? So what we do is we call this the computational Diffie-Hellman problem. Or it's called the CDH problem. Or just CDH. So if you can break the discrete log problem, you can break CDH. But if you can break CDH, it's not necessarily the case that you can break the discrete log problem. In fact, it's strictly the case that you can. Okay, so this is actually it's a weaker security assumption, or it's a stronger assumption that you're making by, if I give you a system and I say its security reduces to CDH, I'm making a stronger assumption, a more generous assumption than if I said you have to break DLP to break it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's actually here it means Z11. So remember that the generator is G, so what's on the base level, they're from GQ. And the exponents, which are the columns in the table, they're going to be between 1 and Q. So that's ZQ. That's right, yeah. That's right as well, yeah. So for every A, if you take A and mod it down by 11, or if you restrict A to ZQ, that's right. So there's only one, let me say this correctly. If you fix G, every unique A value will give you a unique Y to the A value. Yeah, if you change both G and A, then obviously there'll be collisions, yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let me like show it to you just slightly different. So we're going to do the same protocol, but I'm going to change the notation of the protocol to make it a little easier to follow. So let's consider exactly what we were saying, that this is kind of like a hash function. Okay, so if we take x and we do g raised to the power of x mod p, it's kind of like masking x. Okay, so it's sort of like running it through a hash function. What we could do to simplify the notation even more is let's put x in a box. Okay, so I'm going to define g to the x mod p as x in a box. Okay, so if you see x in a box, that means you took g and you raised it to the power of x. Okay. And once it's in the box, you can't take it out, Okay, that's why it's in a box. Okay, and then what we notice is that there's a couple of rules. So we can think of it as being malleability, or homomorphism is the more, or an isomorphism. So the first is, let's say you have x in the box and you have y in a box and you multiply them together. What does that give you? So remember, x in the box, well, I'll write the rule and then we'll reason about it. So it's going to give you x plus y in a box, okay? Because remember, x in a box is g to the x, y in a box is g to the y. I'm just going to drop the mod p for simplicity. So that's going to be g to the x plus y. So that's no different than starting with x plus y and raising it to the power of g. Or raising g to the power of it, I should say. Okay. And then the other thing we can do is if we sort of exponentiate something into the box, then we'll get x times that number that we exponentiated in the box. So g to the x raised to the power of y will give us g to the xy. Okay, so this is just a different sort of notation for thinking about what's going on, where we can just drop all the number theory and just consider, you know, any function that behaves this way, where once you put in the box, you can't get it out, and it has these properties in terms of malleability, then you can do Diffie-Hellman with it, okay? So elliptic curves, for example, is just another way of putting a number in a box such that you can't get it out, and it has these two operations that work in this particular way. So what does Diffie-Hellman look like in this notation? So what Alice will do is she'll choose a value A. She'll send A in a box. Bob will choose a value B. He'll send B in a box. Alice will take B in a box, raise it to her A, so she'll get A, B in a box. Bob will take the A in a box that he received, raise it to his power B, and he'll also get A, B in a box. And so this is the shared secret. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's another important thing. So this technically is B to the A in a box. So let's write it out explicitly that way. And so, yes, we do need the rule of that it's commutative, meaning that, yeah, B times A and A times B are exactly the same. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's go through one other sort of nitpicky point, and then we'll move on to encryption. Okay, so Alice and Bob, they're going to do Diffie-Hellman. That's fine. They get this g to the a, b value, okay? Now, let's just remind ourselves. So g, we know, is in gq, right? Now, if I choose some random number and I compute g to the a, is that in gq or not? Okay, it is. Why is it in gq? Things multiplied by other things in gq are always in gq. This is multiplying g, which is in gq, by itself a bunch of times, so it's going to stay in GQ. Okay. Similarly, G to the B will be in GQ. What about G to the AB? It's the same. Okay, so if I take G to the A, which is in GQ, and multiply by itself B times, I get g to the ab. Or you can think of it as taking g to the b and multiplying it by itself a times. Okay, if this is in GQ, if multiplied by itself a bunch of times, it's going to stay in GQ. Okay, so g to the ab is in GQ. Okay, so what we're holding is a shared number. It's secret. Both of us know it. It's in g to the ab. Now, what do we want to do with this number? Well, what we want to do is we want to, like, I don't know, make it equal to our AES key. Okay, so we want to say, okay, our AES key is going to be g to the ab. All right, now we have a couple of questions that we should think about. First off, is it big enough, right? We need a 128-bit number. So how big is g to the ab? Let me just say. Okay, how big is g to the ab? Okay, remember, g to the ab is mod p. Could g to the ab be bigger than p? Why not? Okay, once you mod it by p, you're going to shrink it down, okay? So mod p means you're going to take some number and you're going to shrink it down to the size of p, okay? So how big is g to the ab? Well, it's the same size as p, okay? How big is p? 2048 bits. Okay, so there's more than lots. There's a whole bunch of, you could generate a bunch of AES keys with one 2048 bit value, okay? Now, the next question we might ask ourselves, is it random? Yeah. Yeah. Because it's mod p, so yeah. Okay, is this going to be a random number? Okay, so I see people shaking their heads. Okay, so if A and B are random, so that's our first consideration. So we did choose A and B at random, okay? And we did say that for every, I didn't write it down, but every A value will give you a different element of GQ, okay? So for every A you choose, you get a unique element of GQ. Therefore, if you choose A randomly, you're going to choose an element of GQ randomly, okay? So it will be random in one sense. Okay, so it's a random element of GQ, assuming that A and B are random. Okay, is that good enough? So let's think back to what GQ actually looks like. So if we go back to last class. Go back two classes. Okay, here we go. So if we're working in G11, mod 23, these are all the elements of GQ. Okay, for this group, they happen to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 9, 12, 13, 16, 18. Okay. Now, let's say We do Diffie-Hellman. We do it in this group. What does that mean? It means g to the ab is going to be one of these numbers. Okay? And what we just said is it will be random. It will be one of these chosen at random with uniform randomness. Okay? The problem is, what if I wanted my AES key to be 10? Will my AES key ever be the number 10? Nope, because 10 isn't in GQ. Okay? So some numbers are in GQ, some of them aren't. Okay? Actually, about half of them are in GQ and half of them aren't. So what that means is we are choosing uniformly random across a certain set of integers, but that set of integers isn't every possible key. Okay? It's only about half of them. Okay? So we have a problem. So if we look at every bit string that's 2,048 bits long, some of those will be elements of GQ and some of them won't, okay? And the ones that aren't will never pick, okay? So if I'm going to do an exhaustive search of your key space, I can just skip over all the things that aren't in GQ and I'll know that you'll never use them, okay? Now, is it that consequential in practice? Maybe not. I mean, I'm cutting down my search space by half, okay? But half isn't a big deal, right? We're going from 128 bits to 127 bits, okay, because it's exponential growth. So you can argue it's not a big deal, but we do like to fix this problem. So what do we have here? Well, what we have is we can think of this as how much entropy is in GQ. So if I say I have a random element of GQ, how much entropy is there? So there's Q of them, right? And I'm choosing them at uniform randomness, okay? So it's going to be the size of Q. So if Q is 2047 bits, I'm going to have 2047 bits of randomness, okay? So we have this value, this GQ. It's not uniformly random, but there is a lot of randomness there. It's what we might call semi-random, right? It's random. Not every value is possible, okay? So it's not uniformly random. But there is a ton of randomness there, way more than we need. We only need 128 bits of randomness, okay? So what do we do if we have a big long thing that's really random, but not every possible value is, or not every value is uniform, and we want to compress it to a shorter value where every value is actually uniformly random? What do we use? So we use an extractor, okay? So this is where extractors show up when we do this. So we'll take our g to the ab, our secret shared value, we'll run it through an extractor, and that will spit out whatever we want. Let's say it's we'll need a 128-bit key for our AES, and let's say we're doing a Mac with it, so we'll need 128 bits for that as well, okay? And usually what happens, like in SSL, for example, Alice will have two keys, an encryption key and a Mac key. Bob will have a different pair of keys. So messages from Alice to Bob will use one set of keys. From Bob back to Alice, it will use a different set of keys. Both parties know all four keys, okay? But they just use different keys. Why? It's sort of complicated. It doesn't really matter. All right, so here we have the amount of entropy we have. It's going to be basically the size of Q. And then this could be, say, 128 plus 128. Or whatever the case may be. Okay. Questions about this or Diffie-Hellman in general? Okay, so this is, I want to stress again, this was a major breakthrough. The invention of this protocol was kind of like the invention of cryptography. There wouldn't be a course called cryptography if it wasn't for this algorithm. And because it did something that seemed impossible. I mean, it sounds, if I just told you, you know, Alice and Bob could never agree on a secret if Eve listens to their entire conversation, that almost seems like it should be true, right? And so people have believed for the longest time that it was true, but it turns out it's not true. And then once people had this insight that you could do seemingly impossible things using cryptography, then we asked ourselves, okay, what other seemingly impossible things could we do? And then there was a whole bunch of results that followed and continue to this day, sort of building on this style approach. Yeah. So it always is, in this case, so in AES, it's always the same encryption key and decryption key. Where we're going to go next is, what if we want to split those functionalities up? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about public key encryption. All right, well, get started again. Just sort of prompted by the discussion at during the break, I'll just go back to this extractor bit. I'll just sort of show you visually what this looks like. So if we say something's in GQ, what that means is, well, it's a number from 1 to P minus 1, or in Z star P. Okay, so what does GQ look like in Z star P? Well, it's going to be some of the numbers, but not all of them. It's going to be roughly half, right? So maybe 1's in it and 2's in it, but then 3 isn't, but 4 is in it and 5 isn't, you know what I mean? So it's going to be this sort of scattering of numbers. Okay, and there's going to be gaps in between numbers. There's going to be consecutive numbers that are all in GQ, whatever the case may be. Okay. So if we pick a random number, what we're just saying is we're picking a random number from one of these lines, but there are gaps between the lines, and you know that there's no key sitting there. So what we'd like to do is turn, we'd like to kind of squish those lines together. So what we'd like to do is get something where all these lines are together, right? Now, there's not going to be enough lines to fill up the whole thing. There's only half of them, okay, but we could fill up the first half. So what's the halfway point? Well, the halfway point is Q, okay, because Q is half of P minus 1. So this goes from 1 to P minus 1. Half of P minus 1 is Q, so this goes from, let's just put 1. Okay. All right, so let's turn our attention to what we're going to call public key encryption. Okay, so we have Alice and Bob, and they want to exchange encrypted messages. And typically what would happen is Alice and Bob would have to, they would have to have the same key, then they could use AES. And then we talked about how Diffie-Hellman would allow us to get the same key. Another alternative we could consider is, what if there was a sort of, what we're going to call public key encryption. So what that means is Alice will encrypt the message for Bob, but she's going to use a key that's publicly known about Bob, okay? So what Bob will do is Bob will come along and he's going to compute a secret key or a decryption key, okay? So it's secret for decryption. And he's going to have a completely different key, which we'll call PK, which is a public key, and it's for encryption. And so the idea is that what Alice would do is she'd go over, I don't know, to Bob's website and say, okay, what's Bob's public key? So Bob would have his public key sitting there, and she'll take that public key, she'll combine it with her message, and that will give a ciphertext, and she'll send that ciphertext over to Bob. And then what Bob will do is he'll decrypt it using his secret decryption key. Sorry, it's wrong. So he'll decrypt the C, the encryption of the message, and that will return back the message itself. Okay, and we have an adversary in the middle as usual. So what does Eve know? So Eve's going to know the public key of Bob. And we want to restrict the adversary in two regards, okay? The obvious thing is she shouldn't be able to compute any info about M. What does that mean to say that she can't compute any information about M? Well, we can actually use the same definitions we use for block ciphers. So we can say encryption's, you know, CPA secure or CCA secure. Now, there's another way that Eve would be able to compute the message, okay? So we do have these key pairs, these public keys and secret keys, okay? And I sort of suggested that they're picked independently. If they're just two random numbers that are picked and they have no correspondence to each other, this will never work, okay? The decryption will never actually undo the sort of the application of the public key, okay? You need the secret key to sort of undo the application of the public key, okay? So what that means is the secret key needs to be related to the public key. There's going to be a mathematical relationship between them such that what we want is if you choose a secret key, you can compute what the public key should be, okay? But what we have to be very careful of is that the opposite isn't true. So if you look at the public key, you shouldn't be able to figure out what the corresponding secret key is. If you did, then you could just decrypt directly, okay? So you cannot compute. SK from PK. And in most public key encryption schemes, in all of them, both of these properties will be true. The reason that they're true might be different. So in this scheme that I'll show you, which is called Algamel, this will be a discrete log thing, and this will be a Diffie-Hellman problem. In RSA, we'll see that one of them is based on factoring, and one of them is based on what's called the RSA problem. Okay, so how are we going to do this? The way we're going to do it is we're going to start with Diffie-Hellman. We're going to try and turn it into an encryption scheme. All right, so here's Bob. Out. Okay, I'm just going to draw it backwards. We said order doesn't matter. I'll just do it this way, which will become clear why. So Bob will send G to the B and Alice will send G to the A. Okay, now both of them can compute G to the AB. G to the AB is a secret. Both of them know it. Okay, it's kind of like a key. If we have a key and we have a message, what can we do to encrypt the message? What's the simplest encryption scheme we can do? If we have a key that we know that's secret that both parties know and we have a message. Okay, so we can just XOR them together. Okay, that's a stream cipher. So if we have a key, we can just XOR them directly. Okay, now XOR here is going to be a little weird because we're working in GQ. If we start XORing things together, there's no guarantee that we're going to stay in GQ. Okay, but why do we use XOR? Well, the idea of an XOR is if you have a message and you have every possible value of the key and you XOR them together, it will give you every possible value for the combination, okay? So as long as we have that same property, we could use a different operation. So what we might use here is multiplication. In other words, if you have a message, you can multiply it by every single number, and that will in turn generate every single number, okay? So that's exactly what we'll do. So we'll take our message, and we'll multiply it by the secret, which is GDDAB. So this is modular multiplication. So you'll notice I dropped all the mod p's, but they are still there. They're implicit. I'm not going to write them out explicitly. And this is kind of like a stream cipher. Okay, so that's it. So that's that is an encryption scheme. That's called LGMEL encryption. The only thing is it looks a little different. I mean, we set it up. We're talking about public keys and secret keys and all of that stuff, right? How does that translate into this particular scheme? So what we're going to do is we're going to call this first value the public key. Okay, so what Bob sends, the G to the B, that's going to be a public key. And Bob can use the same G to the B value for lots of different people. So if he's talking to you or me or someone else in the room, he'll always use that same G to the B. Okay, so he's going to choose the G to the B. He's going to post it on his website, and we're going to call that his public key. Okay, his secret key is going to be B, the secret that corresponds to it, and he's going to use it to decrypt. Okay, now we didn't talk about decrypt. So how do we decrypt? Well, Bob, in this case, he knows C, and he also knows G to the AB. So to get the message back, he's just going to strip it off. So the message will be C divided by G to the AB. Of course, that's not strictly division. It's inverse and multiply. Okay. Now, how did he get G to the AB? Well, he got G to the A from Alice, and he used his decryption key, B, to turn G to the A into G to the AB. He divides it off of C, and he gets the message back, okay? So we consider B to be the secret key or decryption key. And this whole thing we'll call the public key for encryption. Okay, so that's the most basic encryption scheme you can do. So it's called LGMEL. It's just Diffie-Hellman with a message multiplied in at the end. That's all it is. There's nothing more to it. Usually it's not explained in terms of Diffie-Hellman. Usually it's just explained from the bottom up. So let me go through it again, and this time I'll explain it as if it's a public key encryption, but I guarantee you that it's identical to what I just showed you. I'm just going to change the names of some of the symbols. So LGMEL encryption, when we actually conceptualize it, we think of it as basically three steps. So the first step is we're going to generate our public and private keys. So we call this key generation. And so what we're going to do is, before we do anything, we're going to choose our public parameters. So we're going to work mod p save prime with q as a divisor, and we're going to have some generator g. So we'll declare those publicly. Then we'll choose a secret key. For traditional reasons, I'm going to call it X for this explanation. And it's an exponent, so we're choosing it from ZQ. And we're going to have a public key. And the public key is going to be Y equals G to the X mod P. Okay. Now, another thing to notice about this is, what if Alice sends the same message twice? So she'll get the same G to the B value. So she gets the G to the B value. She sends the message hello. So now this A value, she's choosing at random. Okay. So she chooses a random A. She sends G to the A. Then she sends hello times G to the AB. Okay. Now, next time she comes along, she'll start with the same G to the B value, But she'll choose a different random value, A, and then when she encrypts it, she'll send hello times this other value, g to the a, b, okay? So every time she encrypts it, she's choosing a different a. So a in this case is acting kind of like initialization vector, okay? So ElGamel is also a non-deterministic encryption scheme where if you encrypt the same message twice, you're always getting a different result. And it comes from the fact that you're choosing a different a value in this case, okay? So ElGamel is actually CPA secure, and I'll more formally prove it. It'll still be a very informal proof, but I'll try and directly prove that point. But anyways, what we do is we call the randomness that we use, what we're calling A in this diagram, we call it the random factor. And so I'm going to use R instead of A when I describe the encryption. All right, so if I'm going to encrypt a message, I'm going to use the public key, Y. I'm going to take my message, and I'm going to take this random factor. So random factors from Z cubed as well. It's random factor. And what am I going to spit out? Well, notice also the encryption is two values. Okay, it's g to the a and m times g to the a b. Okay, those are the two values. So we calling a g to the r, or we're calling it r, so it will be g to the r. That's what we'll send. Okay, then we want to send this value. Okay, so it's going to be the message times g to the a b. Where do we get g to the a b from? Well, we chose a, and we had g to the b, which was the public key. So what we're going to do is we're going to send it message times the public key raised to the power of R. Okay. So that works out exactly the same. The only difference is we're calling A an R, and Y we're still calling Y. And sometimes we call this, because there's two components, we'll call it C1 and C2. So this is C1 and this is C2. Okay, if we want to decrypt, we're going to use our private key, which is X, and we're going to decrypt the ciphertext, C1 and C2. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this value, M times Y to the R. We're going to turn G to the R into this value. How do we turn it into this value? Well, Y is G to the X. Okay, so we're going to take g to the r, we're going to raise it to x, then we're going to get y to the r, and we're going to strip it off. Okay, so c2 is m times y to the r. Okay, c1 is g to the r. And x is our decryption key. Okay, and what's the relationship between G and Y? Y equals G to the X. Okay, so if you prefer, Y equals G to the X, so we can replace this with G to the X. These will cancel and we'll get M back. Okay. All right. So it's probably a lot easier to see it in this format. But anyways, this is exactly the same protocol. It's just sort of written up with different notation. Yeah. Like what it actually looks like. So you'll choose a random number R, and you'll release G to the power of R. And then you'll take your message and you'll multiply it by the public key, which is G to the X, raised to the same power R. So if you go up here, remember the public key is g to the b, right? And a you can think of as r. So you take g to the a, right? And then you take this value, y to b, and raise it to the power of a. So that's where you get g to the a b from. And you multiply it by your message. Okay. Other questions? Okay, let's go through it one more time. This time I'll use that box notation. All right, so for key generation, what are we doing? We're choosing a secret key X. And we're putting X in a box and we're saying this is our public key. And once it's in the box, you can't get it back out. For encryption, what we're going to do is we're going to choose a random number R. And we're going to put it in a box. So I'll say. Okay. Then we're going to take our message. We're going to multiply it by. So what we're going to do is we're going to take X in a box, essentially. Which is the public key, and we're going to raise it to the power of our R value. So we get R in the box, M times XR in the box. Okay, how do we get our original message back? What we're going to do is we're going to take this value. So we have M times, I'm just going to do a dot. It's a little easier. Okay, so we're going to take M times XR. And what we want to do is we want to strip off XR in a box. Okay, if we can strip off XR in the box, then we'll just get M back. Do we have XR in a box? No. What do we have? We have R in a box, and we have X in a box. We don't know X, but we do know R. Okay? Or sorry, this is the decryptor. We know X, we don't know R. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to start with R in the box. And we're going to raise it to our power of X. So we're going to get M XR in a box divided by XR in a box. And that will release just M. Okay, so this is one of the things where you might have to go through it a few times on paper to see that it really works, but it does really work.
Don't know X.
Yeah. Sorry, so the decryption knows X. So let me put this in. So the person who encrypts, they only know the public key, so they know X in a box. And the person who decrypts, they do know X.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so what's this good for? So what this is good for is this is another way to get an AES key if you want. What I can do is I can just get your public key. First off, I could just send you messages. So like let's say you want to get your inbox from Google. You could say, here's my public key, and then Google says, great, and then they encrypt your message and send it to you. Now, you'll notice that messages M here, and this is a fine point that we'll come back to, they have to be in GQ, okay? And so that means they're limited in size. They're only going to be 2048 bits, okay? So that's not a lot to encrypt. If I want to send you a movie file, you know, it's not never going to fit in 2048 bits, okay? This is also really slow. How fast is it? So modular exponentiations are kind of fast. You can do them in kind of the millisecond range, okay? But doing like AES operations, you can do in one clock cycle, okay? So you can do billions of AESs in the cost it takes to do one modular exponentiation, okay? So what we like to do in practice is we like to sort of use public key encryption to give you an AES key, and then once you have an AES key, then we'll use AES to send you the actual bulk data encrypted. Okay. So what you could do with this scheme is I could just pick an AES key at random, send it to you, and then now you have your AES key. I know it, you know it. I know it because I chose it. You know it because I encrypted it under your public key, and you're the only one that can decrypt it. Then you can go ahead and use it. So we call that key transport. So that's another way of doing key exchange. Okay, and we'll contrast the two later when we talk about SSL. They have slightly different properties depending on whether you choose to do it with Diffie-Hellman or if you choose to do key transport. So let's think about how this works in the real world. So modular exponentiation, I'll just abbreviate mod x, is reasonably fast but it's much slower than AES. Okay. Algebound is limited to 2048-bit messages. Yeah.
Is there a difference between Gamal and symmetrical encryption using
No, so it basically works out to be the same. Yeah. Because it is, Algamel is just Diffie-Hellman essentially. Yeah, it works out to be the same. Algamel is limited to 2048-bit messages. It's actually a little worse than that. Remember, messages in Algamel, because what are we doing with them? Well, what we're doing with a message is we're multiplying it by a GQ element. And so what that means is we want to keep it in GQ. So G is going to be in GQ. Y is G to the X. So if G is in GQ, Y is also going to be in GQ. Okay. So Y to the R will also be in GQ. So everything's in GQ here. G to the R is in GQ. Y to the R is in GQ. We want to make sure that message M is in GQ. Okay. But we go back to this problem where our messages in GQ, some numbers are in it, some numbers aren't. So what if I want to encrypt the number 10 and the number 10's not in GQ, then I have a problem. Okay. So what can we do? Is there a way we can map any integer into GQ and then map it back out when we decrypt? So I don't know if you remember, but when we were going through the number theory, I showed you that if you take a number and square it, that number is always in GQ. Okay. And you can take a square root, that's efficient. You're going to get two results. That's the only problem. And so what you'll do is you'll take a number from 1 to Q. You'll square it. You'll encrypt that. That's in GQ. Then when you decrypt it, you're going to decrypt it. You're going to get two numbers, and you're going to choose the smaller of the two numbers. So why do you get two numbers, and why are you choosing the smaller? Let's look at the chart. So remember, this orange column is the quadratic residues, or the squares, right? So if I want to encrypt the number 8, I'll square it, so that gives me 18, okay? Now, if I want to decrypt it, okay, I'm going to have the number 18, and I'll be sitting here saying, okay, well, if I take the square root of 18, that gives me 8. But if I take the square root of 18, it also gives me 15. In other words, 15 squared is 18, and 8 squared is also 18, okay? So I won't know which of the two is the real message. So what I'll say is I'll only encrypt messages. Notice that this line is symmetrical. So it goes up to this line, and then it's sort of like the mirror image. So there's a 6-6, an 8-8, a 12-12, okay? So as long as I restrict myself either to the first half or the second half of messages, then there's always only one square root that's on one side of this line, okay? So what we do by convention is, we're going to encrypt some number that's between 1 and Q, between 1 and 11. We'll square it, and then we take the square root. If there's two answers, there'll always be two answers. We'll take the one that's between 1 and 11, okay, we'll ignore the square root that's greater than 11. Okay, so that will give us perfect encoding and decoding that's perfectly reversible. Okay, so we'll start with A, and we'll say A is a number between 1 and Q. And we'll map it to some A prime, which is A squared. Mod P. And it's always in GQ. Okay, if we want to go backwards, we start with A prime. And we can go back to A by taking the square root of A, which is the same as A raised to the power of a half, which is the same as A raised to the 2 inverse. Squares always give you two answers, even with real numbers, right? What's the square root of 4? Well, it could be 2 or minus 2. Minus 2 times minus 2 is 2, or is 4, and 2 times 2 is also 4. Okay, so when we take the square root, we'll always get two answers, but only one will be in this range from 1 to Q. Okay, so we'll take that one. The final thing I'll note is this encoding scheme only works for safe primes, which is fine because that's all we're considering in this class. But if you go out in the real world and you're not working in a safe prime group, then this won't work necessarily. Okay, there is something similar that you could do to generalize this idea. And if you're working on elliptic curves, this actually becomes a really hard problem. How do you move arbitrary messages onto elliptic curve points? It's a very non-trivial problem, especially if you want to reverse it. Okay, so that anyway, this is just like a nitpicky kind of thing, but it's something that you need to do, that you need to worry about. Okay, the last thing we'll talk about before moving on from AlGamal is the security. So the first thing we should say is it should be infeasible to compute x given y. Where x is the secret key. And y is the public key. Is that true? Is it infeasible to compute the secret key given the public key? If you post your public key on the website, can I just come along and compute what your secret key is? So no, why specifically? It's that thing from the very first thing we wrote in this class. Okay, so this is exactly the discrete logarithm problem. Okay, that's exactly what it says. It says if you have g to the power of something, you can't get that something in. Okay, x equals the discrete log of y base G, that's impossible, well, infeasible to compute. So you're not going to be able to do it. Okay, so we're safe in that regard. Now, the second thing is, if I look at a ciphertext, what does that tell me about the message? The message is in there somewhere, right? So if I look at it, do I know what the message is? Do I know, can I tell whether it's an even number or an odd number that you encrypted? You know, what exactly can I tell about the message? So what we want to say is you shouldn't be able to tell anything. Okay, it should be infeasible to compute anything. And so we went through this whole definition of what that meant. And we had different levels of security like OTS, CPA, and CCA. So AlgaML, it turns out, is CPA secure. Because it's randomized, you're choosing that random factor differently every time. Encrypting the same message twice will give you a different answer. So it is a candidate for CPA security, and it actually achieves that level of CPA security. It's not CCA secure, okay? And we'll talk about why it's not CCA secure in a bit. But let's show that it is CPA secure. Okay, so AlgaML is CPA secure. We can prove it. It's secure under an assumption that's slightly different than the discrete log problem. Okay, so we talked about how there is this other assumption that underlies Diffie-Hellman called the computational Diffie-Hellman problem or CDH problem. There's another, a third variant that's called the DDH problem or the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem. Okay, DLP is the hardest. If you break it, you break all three. CDA is the second hardest. If you break it, it breaks DDH, but not necessarily DLP. And then DDH is the weakest. So if you break it, it's not necessarily the case that you can break the other two. In fact, there are groups where we know how to break DDH, but we don't know how to break either CDH or DLP. That turns out to be a feature, not a bug, as long as you know ahead of time that that's the case. And so that unlocks a bunch of crypto protocols that weren't possible before. So I mentioned the pairing-based encryption. So that's technically, at a technical level, what it does is it allows you to solve DDH, but not CDH or DLP. But anyways, this is all acronym soup to you because I haven't actually defined what these things are. So just a recap before we do the proof. In the setting of integers mod p, we have three basic or standard infeasibilities, or I'll say infeasible assumptions, feasibility assumptions. Okay, so the first is the DLP problem, which says it's infeasible to compute, x given g to the x. We have CDH, which says it's infeasible to compute g to the xy given g to the x, and g to the y. Okay, so this is the Diffie-Hellman thing, right? The adversary sees these three values. They're not able to compute g to the xy, but Alice and Bob are able to both compute this value. So the third one is what we call DDH, or decisional Diffie-Hellman. And it's a little more complicated of a definition, but It basically, what we're going for is, instead of saying not only can you not compute g to the xy, you actually can't compute anything about g to the xy. Okay, so you can't even compute a single bit of what it should be. Okay, and so if we want to say you can't learn any information about it, basically you can stare at these three values and it should tell you nothing about g to the xy. How do we formalize that idea that you can, it tells you nothing? So one way we can do it is we can say, well, what if I told you either g to the xy, the true value, or I just picked a random value out of thin air? Could you actually tell the difference? Could you decide whether I'm showing you the real g to the xy or I'm just showing you a random value? And if the answer is, well, you can't tell the difference, then obviously those three values don't leak anything about it. Okay, so that's exactly what decisional Diffie-Hellman says. So it's infeasible to distinguish g to the a, g to the b, and some value I'll call z, which is chosen randomly from GQ. Or the real value, which is g to the a, g to the b, and g to the ab. Okay. So basically, I flip a coin, and on heads, I'll give you these four values. On tails, I'll give you these four values. And your job isn't to tell me what g to the ab is. All your job is to do is say, okay, that in that case, you chose the random number, or in the other case, you chose g to the ab. Okay. Now, it turns out that this is a... So if we think of the hardness of these problems, so DLP is the hardest, strictly harder than CDH, and this is harder than, I'll just do it like this. Okay, so this is the easiest, but it's still thought to be hard. In fact, it's thought to be roughly as hard as DLP. Like I said, there are some groups where you can break this assumption and not break these two assumptions. When you start doing things on elliptic curves, there's special curves that have special properties that allow that. But generally over the integers, the best algorithm we know for solving the DDH problem is to just break the discrete log. And then once we break the discrete log, then we decide whether it's which of the two things we're looking at.
In DDH, you use AB, and in DDH, you use X and Y, but both are the same.
Sorry. I just kind of switched. So let me make it consistent. It could be cleaner. Okay, so let's think about El-Gamal. So I'm going to prove El-Gamal is CPA secure using DDH. And then I'll sketch out a proof of it not being CCA secure. Okay, so let's remind ourselves of what the adversary sees. So what the adversary sees when they look at an interaction, she's going to see the public parameter, P and Q and all of that stuff. We'll just note G, that's the most important one. She's going to see the public key of the person that's receiving it, Bob. And she's going to see a ciphertext. Okay? So G, she sees when they decide the parameters. Y, she goes to Bob's website and gets the public key. And C, she sees it go across the wire. Okay. Now, if we expand this out, we're going to get G, Y, and then let's remind ourselves of what C is. So it's going to be a G to the power of R and an M times Y to the R. Okay. Now, what is y? So recall that y is g to the x. So without changing the numbers, let's just put everything in terms of g. Okay, so instead of y, we'll think of it as g to the x. We have a g to the r. We have m times y to the r, which is y is g to the x. So y to the r would be g to the xr. Okay, now let's compare this to, for example, let's say I gave you these three numbers instead. So I gave you g, g to the x, g to the r. I took your message, and instead of multiplying it by g to the xr, I just multiply it by some random number z. What we can say under the DDH assumption, if DDH is true, you can't tell the difference, okay? So I can make this change, okay? I should be clear, who am I in this case? I'm not the adversary, I'm not anything. I'm a theoretician that's proving to you some property. I'm a mathematician, okay? So if I were to make this change, in other words, if Alice were to send this across the wire instead of sending this across the wire, could Eve tell the difference? The answer is no, okay? So these are indistinguishable. Under DDH. Okay, now consider another sort of permutation on the same idea. What if instead of sending M times Z, I just sent Z? Could you tell the difference between these two? In other words, if I choose a random number and multiply it by the real message, or I just choose a random number, what's the difference between the two? So it turns out there's no difference because of the one-time pad issue. So if Z is truly random, if it's a truly random number, when you multiply a message by a truly random number, that's like a one-time pad. So you get perfect security. In other words, every number here is going to be from uniform distribution of all the numbers that are possible, which is the definition of a random number. So this is going to be some number in GQ chosen at random. This is also going to be some number in GQ chosen at random as well. Okay. So this moving from here to here is just a one-time pad. So it's going to be perfectly indistinguishable, not just computationally, but perfectly indistinguishable. Okay, how much, if I send this across the wire, how much does that leak about the message? Could you compute what the message is by looking at these four values? Why not? This is like a kind of a stupid question. Like it's an obvious question, so don't be scared if your answer sounds too obvious. Why can't you learn anything about seeing g, g to the x, g to the r, and some random number? Why does that tell you nothing about the message? Okay, the message is not there anywhere, right? So obviously it's not going to leak anything about the message, okay? So this last line leaks nothing about the message because the message isn't there. So if we walk back up, if we start at the bottom, we have something that leaks nothing about the message. We have something that's indistinguishable from something that leaks nothing about the message. Therefore, this doesn't leak anything about the message. And then we have something that's indistinguishable from something that doesn't leak anything about the message. Therefore, this is also this also leaks nothing about the message. Okay? So let's say it again. So this leaks nothing about the message. Okay? This is just the one-time pad version of this. So if this doesn't leak anything about the message, then this isn't going to leak anything either. And this and these two things are indistinguishable. Okay, so if this isn't leaking anything about the message, then this isn't leaking anything about the message either. Assuming DDH is true. If DDH isn't true, then all bets are off. Okay, so that's how we prove essentially that it doesn't leak anything about the message. Yep, so indistinguishable means there is an algorithm where you can tell these two things apart. It's just going to take the lifetime of the universe to run it. This, even if you have the lifetime of the universe, you'll never tell them apart. They're just, you can't tell them apart. Let me I'll just give these numbers so that they're easier to refer to. So we'll call this line 1, we'll call this line 2. Okay, so it's going to leak no info about him. Now, how you turn this into winning the CPA game, I'll leave that. Essentially, once you show it leaks no information, you can turn it into CPA secure. I'll just skip that set for time. Okay. Now, the other thing we can say about Elgamal is it's not CCA secure. Okay, why was it that we had a bunch of things that weren't CCA secure? What was the sort of deficit or the deficiency, the defect is the best word. What was the sort of defect in the things that we were looking at that made it so that they weren't CCA secure? Okay, so they were malleable. They had malleability problems. Okay, so Elgamal is not going to be CCA secure essentially because it's malleable. Now, its malleability is sort of a blessing and a curse. So on one hand, it's not going to give you CCA secure, so that sounds like a bad thing. On the other hand, if I encrypt some data and you're able to do things like, I don't know, multiply numbers into it or do things like that, what you can do is you can think of it as sort of like you're computing on encrypted data. So I give you some secret and you can run some computations on it even though you don't know what the data is, and then you could hand me back the result and then I could decrypt it with that computation applied. Okay, so the fact that Elgamal is malleable is actually a very useful feature in some cases. So if you want to send messages across the wire and not have anybody be able to change them, then it's a really bad thing. Okay, but if you want to do things like, I don't know, let's say you do a voting scheme and everyone's going to sort of encrypt their vote and then you want to add them up under encryption without learning how everyone voted, you could use exactly these kinds of malleabilities in order to do it. Okay. So this, when it follows a very strict, there's a strict definition, but when it follows a strict sort of mathematical relationship. So it's not like flipping a bit ruins this block and then flips the same bit. That's kind of like a weird form of malleability. But when there's a really nice, clean mathematical relationship, we call it a homomorphism. And so that's exactly what ElGamal has. And you can look at your project at homomorphic encryption, in particular something called fully homomorphic that's interesting to study. But anyways, let's think about ElGamal. So let's say I have the encryption of some message and I multiply it by some constant A. What does that really mean? Well, we know that there's two components to the ciphertext. There's C1 and C2. So what I'm going to say is we're just going to multiply C2 by A. We're not going to multiply both of them. Okay? But if we define it in that way, what we end up with is G to the R. We have M times Y to the R times A. Okay, and that's going to be the same as M times A times Y to the R. And that's going to be the same as the encryption of MA under randomness R. Okay, so if we multiply a constant into C2, then it's the encryption of the message times that constant, even though we have no idea what the message is. Okay, so if this is my salary going across the wire, and I make this a number 2, I can take C2, multiply it by the number 2, then when the person receives it and they decrypt, they'll get double the value of the salary. And at no point did I actually learn what my salary was, okay? So my message is still secure, still CPA secure. That's not a violation of CPA security, okay? It seems like we shouldn't be able to do that, right? We shouldn't call that secure encryption if you can do an attack like that. That's why we have the definition of CCA security. So CCA security is going to say, no, you can't do that. That's actually a bad thing. But ElGamal isn't CCA secure. Okay, it's only CPA secure.
So did you double your salary or not?
Yep, so I doubled it. Yeah, no problem, no sweat. Okay, now another thing we can do is, so this is sort of the basic homomorphism. What if we have the encryption of two messages? And we multiply it by the encryption of some other message. Okay, once again, we're going to have to define what this means exactly because we have two different ciphertexts. But we can think of this as a kind of like a dot product. So what we're going to do is we're going to compute C1. This is going to get confusing. I think I solved this before. Yeah. Okay, let me call this M prime instead of M1 and M2. Okay, so we have C1 and C2 times C1 prime, C2 prime. And if we interpret multiplication in this way, so it's C1 times C1 prime, and then C2 times C2 prime. Then if you work it out, we'll get G to the R prime. And we'll have M times Y to the R times M prime times y to the r prime. Okay, so this is going to give us g to the r plus r prime. It's going to give us m times m prime times y to the r plus r prime. Okay, and so that's going to be exactly the same as the encryption of m times m prime. The randomness will change from r or R prime to R plus R prime, okay? But you will get the encryption of M times M1. And notice that when you decrypt, you don't care about what the randomness is. The randomness can be anything, and you can always decrypt it, okay? For completeness, let me just add the R up here as well. Okay, so as I said, the pro of this is you can sort of compute on encrypted data. With ElGamal, you can only do a multiplication, so that's fine. That's pretty powerful. There's a lot of things you can do with multiplications. And what you can also do is, you can also exponentiate. I didn't show it, but if you exponentiate in a number that you know, then it will also exponentiate into this value here. So anyway, you can compute on encrypted data. You can do a limited number of computations. What if you want to be able to do any computation possible? Then what you would need is you would need both an addition and a multiplication, or you would need, say, a NOR gate or a NAND gate or something like that. So there are a couple small operations that if you can just do that one operation, then you can do any computing. And so it turns out that they call that fully homomorphic encryption. It was thought to be impossible for a long time, or at least no one had been able to come up with a scheme that allowed fully homomorphic encryption. And then a few years ago, I guess it's going on to about 10 years now, someone found a solution to fully homomorphic encryption. Very slow. It's not really at the practical level, but anyways, it is possible. You can do it. You can do a project on it if that sounds like something that's interesting. Okay, so the con is it's not CCA secure. Okay, so let's go back to our statement. AlgaML is not CCA secure. So I'm not going to repeat the CCA game, but I'll show you how to break it. So at the heart of the game, what you do is you start by choosing two messages. You choose, call it M1 and M2 as your challenge messages. You're going to receive CB, which is the encryption of either M1 or M2. You don't know, so we'll just call it MB. And we can't do anything with CB, okay? We can't ask for a decryption of it, but we can ask for the decryption of anything that we want, okay? As long as it's not CB, okay? So what we'll do is we'll ask of CB prime. Okay, so we have to change CB somehow, okay? So we're going to start with CB and then we're going to change it. Now remember, what we can do is we can do all these things like multiply numbers in and things like that, okay? So what could we do to change CB so that it ends up being a different value, but it's still useful for us in distinguishing whether CB is an encryption of M0 or M1? Okay, what we could do is, first off, we can multiply it by 1. Okay, if we multiply it by 1, then we'll get an encryption of the same message. But when we multiply it by 1, it doesn't actually change the number. Okay, anything multiplied by 1 is just that number. Okay, so we do have to change it somehow. Okay, but what we could do is look at this homomorphism. So if we multiply the encryption of two messages together, okay, we get their multiplication encrypted. And the randomness changes, meaning it is a different encryption of that same number, okay? So let's consider this as being MB, okay? What could this be? What if this was an encryption of 1? Okay, if we take the number 1 and we encrypt it and we multiply it by MB encrypted, what do we get? We get MB times 1, which is MB, okay? But because the randomness will change, it is actually a brand new ciphertext. Okay, it's not exactly the same. So what we'll do is we'll do this, call this the encryption of 1. Okay. So this will be the encryption of MB, but it will be under new randomness. Okay, specifically it will be the randomness that we chose here. So we're going to choose the randomness added to whatever randomness the Oracle chose when they encrypted this value. call this RB. Call this R. Okay, so then what do we get? So we ask for a decryption of CB, then we get MB. Okay, so we get it directly, and then we just say, okay, is that equal to M0 or M1? Okay, this idea, this step we call re-randomization. And so it's also useful in a lot of protocols. So basically what you could do is if I hand you an encrypted value, you could change it into a new value that I don't even recognize, but it's still the encryption of the same value. Okay, so it's using some sort of privacy-preserving protocols where you want some privacy. So some person will take the value, they'll kind of shift it. And one of the features is if you re-randomize a value, you can't tell whether it's the re-randomization of, like, say I give you the original value and then I give you a re-randomization of it. You can't tell whether it's actually a re-randomization of the original value or some new encryption of some new message. They're completely indistinguishable from each other. Okay. Another thing you could do, if you don't like this, is this sounds too complicated. Just pick M0 and M1, like say random numbers. You get CB, just multiply it by 2. Decrypt it, you'll get some message, divide it by 2, and then it's either going to be M0 or M1. Okay, that's another perfectly sensible way of breaking the game that's maybe a little easier to understand. Exactly, yeah. So how is it the case that R doesn't matter? So let's go back and look at decryption. So this is decryption in ElGamel. And so you'll notice that when you decrypt, you're using C2 and C1. Both of these have the same R. So R is basically encoded in C. So when you decrypt, you never learn what R is. Okay? The only thing you need to be guaranteed is that the same R value that's here and the same R value is here. Otherwise, you don't care. So as long as you preserve that property of keeping the R values the same, you can decrypt it.
And using the same randomness more than one time, does it break the secrecy of
that? Yeah, so what happens if your random number generator is broken and you encrypt the same message twice? That's a great exam question, by the way. Okay, so what happens? So it breaks CPA security. So basically, what will happen is, yeah, if I encrypt the same message more than once, then you'll just observe that it's the same message. You won't know what message is being encrypted, so you can't decrypt it, but you will know that the same message is being encrypted twice. So if you think of that Linux penguin, if you're going to ElGamel encrypt every pixel, then every time you encrypt that shade of gray, it's always going to come out to the same result if that R value is the same. Okay, other questions? Okay, so maybe a lot to process in this lecture. I know we moved kind of fast through it. So take some time, go over it, and make sure you understand it. And come with your questions next class if anything's not clear. I'll see you next class. Thanks.